Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is James Howard Kunstler. He's the author of many books, including nonfiction, The Geography of Nowhere, The City in Mind, Notes on the Urban Condition, Home from Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. His novels include World Made by Hand, The Witch of Hebron, Maggie Darling, A Modern Romance, The Halloween Ball, An Embarrassment of Riches, and many others. He's published three novellas with Walter Street Press, Manhattan Gothic, A Christmas Orphan, and The Flight of, can you say it please?
Mehetabal.
So first off, thank you for all of your decades of fabulous work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, well, the first, it weren't nothing. And the second, you're quite welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. So I would like to start with a line of yours that I just love, which is, we need to be reality-based adults. So my first question is, what are some of the realities that people around the world, first off, what do you mean by that? Which is embarrassing to even have to ask. Second, what are some of the realities that people around the world are not facing? And what are some of the adult responses to these quandaries?
Well, you'll have to remind me about two and three after I get through with number one. But more and more, we're living in a kind of reality optional culture. And, you know, I was just thinking about that kind of hard this morning when I was writing to a friend of mine in Australia. And she's an American who hasn't been here for a while. And, you know, she's marveling at the idiocy of the current, you know, media hysteria in America and the political conversation in general, the conversation in the public arena. And what I'm beginning to think is this, in relation to the reality optional culture, that there is a kind of subconscious cognition of the group, of the collective, that we're in a lot of trouble. And that it's generating so much collective anxiety that it's starting to make our political conversation and our economic conversation completely incoherent. There are other ways of looking at this. I wrote about one in my blog this week at clusterfucknation at kunstler.com. And this way of looking at it is called the Overton window. And that's a sort of socio-political mechanism of understanding how groupthink works. And we've got this fantastic groupthink operating now, especially in the United States. And one of the features of it is after the traumatic financial crash of 2008 and all of the suffering that it entailed, especially among the middle class, much of which was ruined by that crash, we entered a period in American history of wishful thinking. And the wishful thinking was largely revolved around the kind of techno-narcissistic, techno-grandiose ideas that we were going to tech our way through this apprehended set of problems, the subconsciously apprehended set of problems that are just overwhelming us, the problems of the planetary ecology crashing, the problems of the human population overshoot, the problems of peak oil, which, by the way, is still very much with us. It's just not understood at all in the public discussion. The problems of resource scarcities and the especially recondite and abstruse problems of finance and economy. I think that has provoked, this unwillingness to engage with reality. So, these are some of the issues that we're not able to think about. We're not able to think about our energy quandary, which, by the way, is very much related to the financial problems we have, because we've been generating enormous amounts of debt in order to pay for the way we live in the absence of truly affordable energy in the way that it had been affordable for most of the last 100 years. And there are examples of this that are kind of interesting. The discussion about electric cars and driverless cars. You know, this is now all the fashion in nerd circles in America. You know, the idea that the driverless electric car is going to save American society from being stranded. Of course, the thing that's so amazing and interesting about it is that it presumes that a car-dependent lifestyle can continue or ought to continue, or that there's something good about it, when in fact, you know, I basically am, started to become known in my writing for inveighing against the suburban living arrangement in my first book, The Geography of Nowhere. And, you know, that's been a big theme for me ever since. And this living arrangement is self-evidently futureless. You know, we're just not going to be able to continue it for reasons that are obvious. You know, we're going to run into resource problems, and especially energy resource problems, you know. And we can't continue it. We've got to find a way to move back into traditional living arrangements of towns, villages, neighborhoods, real rural land, not half-assed suburbanized rural land. You know, we're going to have to reestablish the distinction between what's rural and what's urban, and the activities that are rural, you know, like farming and food production and grazing, that's the stuff that takes place in the rural places, and other stuff takes place in the urban places. They're probably going to have to get a lot smaller. In any case, you know, we're not willing to have that conversation. All we're willing to do is think about new ways that we can continue to be car dependent. And it makes us look like we're absolutely insane. And it is basically a reality averse conversation. And it's sort of an example of the kind of things that we can't talk about.
So there's before I turned on the recorder, I was commenting on how rich your work is, and the richness of your work creates, in a sense, it makes for a wonderfully easy interview on one level, because I just have to say one word and you can take off and go whatever direction you want. On the other hand, it makes it for a really difficult interview, because it's like I have 15 choices I can make as to where to take what you've just said, because there's so many great things there.
Yeah, I apologize for running on at the mouth.
No. I didn't say it that way. I wasn't meaning that. I was actually telling the truth, and B, giving you a compliment. That it's like there's so much richness. And I'm going to throw out a couple. You take whatever you want.
All right.
One of them is this notion of being faced with these huge, literally world-changing problems, like the collapse of the oceans.
Yeah.
I'm an environmental activist, you know, I've written bazillions of books on that, and there's a part of me that cannot believe that this culture is actually killing the oceans. And
yeah.
So there's this line from Judith Herman's book Trauma and Recovery, the first or second line is something about how trauma is something that is so awful that it is beyond words. That's the meaning of the word unspeakable. So I guess what I'm saying is, one direction is, so many of the things we're facing are so horrific and so large that it's like really easy to just, hey, you know, I think solar panels will solve all the problems, to search for easy non-solutions that affect how we feel more than how the reality is. That's one thing. And I'll say one more thing and then I'll shut up. And another possibility, like two more things. Another possibility is to talk about what you were saying about car culture being non-sustainable, which is embarrassing. We even have to say that out loud too. And the third possibility is I interviewed this guy recently who has this really interesting thing about how community has changed. And I love his language, because he's not saying this is a good thing. He says community has changed from being place-based to aspirational-based. So instead of it being based on reality, as you're talking about, it's based on what we wish. And so take any of those any direction you want.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, there's an app for that. I think that's our general idea of how we solve problems these days. You know, that you just get the app. If the ocean's collapsing, you get the ocean regeneration app. and plug it into your iPhone, make the ocean just fine. The whole suburban car dependent matrix is of endless fascination to me, and it represents, you can view it in a lot of ways, you know. I like to think of it as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world, and as a living arrangement with no future. And as I said, it has no future because, you know, we're not going to have the oil products to run it. We're not going to substitute alt energy devices to take the place of the oil based things that we're doing now. That's a fantasy, and it's largely a fantasy because you can't really fabricate, manufacture, and run that stuff without an underlying platform of a fossil fuel economy. So a lot of people are, you know, wasting their time and wasting their hopes, dreams, wishes, and fantasies on that.
And wasting everybody else's time, too, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And especially in a time, in a very urgent moment in human history when we don't have a whole lot of time to waste fooling around with this stuff. There's an angle to the thing. I'm sorry to digress again, but
no, please do.
There's an angle to what we were talking about earlier, which is why and how we got to a reality optional culture. And you know, one of the things that ought to fascinate us is the idiocy of the things that intellectuals are interested in today. You know, especially if you think about it politically. You know, if you think that, the university people and the academics and the policy people are largely in the Democratic political pool in the United States, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would.
You know, for the most part, I mean, there are conservative intellectuals, but an awful lot of the professional, you know, cadre of paid intellectuals are in the Democratic fold. And look at the things that they're interested in today, you know, transsexualism. You know, how important is that? I mean, what percentage of the population is transsexual, and how much can we really do about their psychological quandaries as a political thing?
You know? I would just like to point out that the New York Times, talk about non-reality based, the New York Times talks about human beings transitioning from male to female.
Yeah.
And biologically, that's not how it works.
Well, that's because it's a reality optional newspaper.
Exactly. A simulation of a thing is not the thing itself. So yeah. The stodgy New York Times, which worries very much about whether you should use that or which in a sentence, has made biology optional, which is stunning to me.
Yeah, and you know, it's an indication of our increasing inability to think clearly about anything. You know, the final product of all that is we become unable to construct a coherent consensus about what's happening to us. And therefore, we cannot make a coherent plan to do anything about it. Now,
Sorry to interrupt, consensus. Did you say coherent consensus of what is happening to us?
Yeah, we can't construct a coherent consensus about what is happening to us.
Can you be specific? Sorry to interrupt, but can you be specific about what you mean by what is happening to us? I agree with you. I just want more detail.
Yeah. Well, for example, the suburban matrix we were just talking about, you know, it's self-evident that we're going to really have to reorganize the physical arrangement of living on the terrain of North America. We're not going to be able to continue to live in suburban Dallas and Minneapolis and the Washington Beltway suburbs. You know, that stuff is going to fail, and it's going to fail grotesquely and badly. And, you know, what our destination really is having to return to walkable communities. But we're unable to even have a conversation about that. You know, every conversation about transportation that we're having is just about how to substitute one sort of motive power for another. You know, we never talk about maybe it would be a good thing if we became conscious of the need to move back to walkable communities and neighborhoods. And you know, I was associated with the New Urbanism movement for many years. I still am. And that was, you know, their principal contribution. And, you know, I think it's one of the few kind of programmatic things in our culture that actually offers something concrete. Look, you know, if we're going to survive this bottleneck that we're heading through of, you know, planetary problems, there's no question that we're going to have to make our shit smaller. We're going to have to make it more local. We're going to have to resize and rescale virtually all of our activities and probably our institutions. And this is an enormous task, and we're not able to even think about it. Here's another example. Probably one of the things that we could have done in the last 20 years to mitigate the problems with the way we live physically in America is we could have rebuilt the conventional railroad system in America. But, you know, we were too techno-narcissistic. We were only able to think of you know, building a high-speed rail system. And now we can't do that because we missed the window of opportunity for doing that when there was still a lot of wealth in the system, or at least nominal wealth. You know, the other countries who did it, France and Spain and China, you know, they got it all done in the 1990s and early 2000s. You know, we just blew it off because we weren't interested. Not for any good reason. We just weren't interested in doing it. We were more interested in driving around. So we didn't do it. But it's tremendously important, because if we don't have a conventional railroad system that works, that connects up all the localities in America, we're not going anywhere in North America. North America is a very big continent. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons why it would have been a good idea. First of all, it was a project that could have been done fairly easily. The infrastructure is mostly still there, lying out in the rain, rusting away, but it's still there. Okay, it's something we've done already. We know how to do it. It would put tens of thousands of people to work at all levels of work, from management to labor, and would have created a lot of jobs. But most of all, it would have given us some sense that there was something we could do about our situation. And made it possible, built our confidence up to approach the other things that we have to do. For example, we're going to have to re-engineer the way we do farming and food production in this country. It's probably going to have to be on a much finer and smaller basis with smaller farms. It's probably going to have to be much more organic. It's probably going to require much more human attention and less mechanical, or at least you know, engine-powered activity. You know, it's obvious, it's self-evident, we're going to have to do that. We're not going to have the natural gas-based herbicides and fertilizers, for one thing, you know, to just pour them on these sterile soil mediums to grow giant industrial crops of pepperoni sticks and corn. Or, well, you know, cheese doodles, whatever we're growing out there in Iowa. You know, but these are projects that we need to think about, and we're not even thinking about this stuff. It's not even in the arena. So, you know, all we're thinking about is, you know, how we can make transsexuals more comfortable in our culture.
So, two directions, again, you can choose or do both. One of them is that a dear doctor friend of mine is doctor by day, environmentalist by night, and I love how he applies the medical model has problems, but let's leave that aside. The medical model to many things. And what I mean by medical model is he always says the first step toward proper treatment is correct diagnosis. And the reason I'm saying all that is because this is part of what you're saying, it seems to me, is look, people, we need to do an accurate diagnosis. And if we look at how environmentalists are approaching the problems they face, instead of it being, look, you have emphysema, we are going to, you know, you need to do this, this, this to fix the emphysema. Instead, it's, well, you have emphysema, so why don't I give you a lollipop because it'll make you feel good?
Yeah, and it'll be a solar-powered lollipop.
Yeah, exactly.
And I saw this very clearly with, you know, I had some brushes with Amory Lovins in the Rocky Mountain Institute, and they were like the poster child for this kind of idiotic thinking. And, you know, they were a leading environmental foundation in America, still are, I suppose. And for years, they were working on this project that they called the hypercar. And the whole idea of the hypercar was it would be exquisitely aerodynamic, and it would get fantastic, supernaturally great gas mileage. And that would solve the problem of energy resources, right? I mean, Amory Lovins apparently gave not one second of thought to the idea that maybe a car-dependent suburban existence is not the best way for people to live, and maybe we ought to engineer something different than that instead of building hypercars. But, I mean, that's the level of thinking that's out there, and it's just, it ought to be appalling. It's just astounding.
The book I'm writing right now is called Bright Green Lies, and it's exactly on this crap. Having said that, you've mentioned peak oil early on and how it's playing out, but then you used a phrase, I don't remember exactly what, but basically playing out in ways perhaps people didn't expect. I don't remember exactly what your phrase was.
That's quite right. It's not exactly what I said, but that's quite right.
So can you define peak oil for listeners and then talk about how you perceive it playing out?
Well, what peak oil is really about is peak oil that is economically that makes economic sense. Peak oil is about oil resources that make economic sense to get out of the ground. And by that I mean what we say is the energy return on investment for oil. And that means, you know, how much energy does it take to get a barrel of oil out of the ground? At the peak of, you know, the American industrial adventure, let's say the 1950s, we basically got about 100 barrels of oil out of the ground for every equivalent barrel that we put into the operation. By the 1990s, it was down to about 30 odd barrels of oil back for every barrel we put in. Now it's about 17. So what you can see is that, you know, the amount of payback you're getting for the investments that you're making in getting oil are going down, down, down. And in some cases, you know, we're past the point where it even makes any economic sense to even pursue it. For example, the shale oil, quote, miracle, unquote, that people have been touting for the last 5 years. You know, this is the thing that's going to allow happy motoring to continue forever. There's, you know, I said we lived in a wishful thinking society, and there's something I call the master wish, which is, please, God, can we keep on driving to Walmart forever? Okay, that's the master wish. And shale oil seemed to be the answer to that. Wow, you know, we'll be able to just frack and frack and get oil and no problem. Well, you know, it turns out that almost none of the operations for getting shale oil out of the ground are economically rational. They all lose money. The whole thing's been a Ponzi scheme based on the low interest rate financial shenanigans of the central banks. And what we're going to see is that these companies drilling in the shale deposits have borrowed enormous amounts of money that they'll never be able to pay back. They'll reach a point where they won't be able to get more money to continue their operations. And one by one, they're going to go bankrupt and production is going to go way down again. So, you know, you can think of shale oil as basically having been a kind of a stunt to make it appear that we could continue living the way we do. And, you know, frankly, that a lot of the stuff that we do in terms of policy and in, you know, group decisions and group activities are kind of Potemkin activities designed to disguise the fact that we probably can't keep going like this. So, you know, it's very discouraging to live in a culture that is that out of touch and that reality averse, but, you know, that's where we're at. So right now, the public is especially confused because gasoline at the pump seems to be extra cheap, you know, and the price of oil per barrel has gone down so much in the last 2 years. So it's now like $43 a barrel today, I guess. The trouble is the companies that drill for oil can't make money at $43 a barrel. So, you know, they'll pretend that they're in business for another couple of years and then they'll be gone. And then we will be truly in a condition of with a supply problem, and then the price will go up again. But you know, we're liable to probably have scarcity problems before we even have another protracted price rise. So that's where we're at.
So haven't you said that? And I'm sorry if I get the numbers wrong. My memory is just crap. But haven't you said that basically the economy requires that oil be below, I don't remember what it is, $60 a barrel, but the oil companies, in order to function, require it to be above a certain price. So there's a very narrow
range. That's
the
basic equation. But it was 75. The price of oil per barrel above $75 a barrel crushes economies, and below $75 a barrel it crushes oil companies. So it's a real predicament.
So if I were to try to boil down your work into a couple of phrases, please forgive me if this is inaccurate, but it seems to me it would be that the oil age has been a one-time blowout, and one may, because one's entire economy and way of life is based on it, one might want to think about what that means for the future.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, fair summary.
Okay, I'm going to bring in somebody else for a second. That is the great Upton Sinclair line about it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it.
Yeah.
And how much of that is playing into so much of my own work is so concerned with how and why it is concerned with denial and how we can, you know, be killing the oceans and not attending or whatever it is we're doing, how we can have a way of life based on oil and think that, suddenly having 1% or for God's sake, Marc Jacobson, thinking you can power the entire economy with wind and solar. It's completely nuts. So why the magical thinking? I know you've been saying this again and again, but I don't think people can hear it enough. The magical thinking?
Well, I think there's one phrase that I've been using. I didn't originate it, but I think it's true, that is very helpful in understanding. It is called the psychology of previous investment. You know, some people refer to sunk costs, which is a very similar concept. And, the psychology of previous investment means that you put so much of your personal wealth and your collective wealth of your society and your identity into a certain set of beliefs and activities that you can't imagine letting go of them. I mean, that's exactly what's wrong with the suburban predicament. We've spent most of the wealth of the post-World War II USA on constructing this matrix of suburban crap, and now we're stuck with it. And we can't imagine, you know, changing it or reforming it or doing it without it. I'd have to say that the new urbanists actually did a yeoman's job of imagining a way to change it and reform it. But, you know, they were barely listened to by the culture and barely paid attention to. And so it's very difficult for us to overcome the psychology of previous investment. Now, I think that's it in a nutshell. And, you know, it's a gigantic thing. It affects all of the so-called narratives that we spin out for ourselves. And, of course, narratives are not the same as the truth. And that's why we live in a reality-optional society for the moment. I one more thing about this. If you think of a sine, cosine waveform, which is just a simple waveform that goes up and down and up and down, I think there are moments in history when groups or cultures or societies are more self-aware and more conscious and more able to understand what's happening to them. And then there are times at the bottom of the trough where societies really just, you know, are unable to put it together. And that's where we're at. It's tragic and sad and unfortunate, and that's where we happen to be at the moment.
So reality-based and non-reality, or a non-reality-based worldview, one of the first words that comes to mind is postmodernism. And would you like to take a swing at postmodernism?
Well, postmodernism is a grab bag of a lot of things. A lot of things. I mean, you know, it's an architectural movement. It's an art movement. It's a kind of a set of political views of, or geopolitical thinking. So it's a lot of things. But the most, perhaps the most pernicious thing about it is that it grows out of the increasingly self-referential pseudo-metaphysical bullshit that emanates from the graduate schools. You know, and you can see this a lot in the, because I traffic a lot with the architects and the city planners and stuff, you can see it a lot in the graduate schools of architecture and art, where every graduate student has to spin out a new metaphysic to kind of explain, you know, some crazy-ass new way of novelty thing that they've introduced into, you know, a way of designing a building. You know, under the rubric of postmodernism, it's really not okay to emulate any kind of past cultural success. So if someone has learned how to do, you know, design a neighborhood or a church or a school or a home, you know, you can never do it. You can never employ those devices in your own design. You have to come up with something completely new, and then you have to come up with a metaphysic, a metaphysical theory to back it up. And so we've just been involved or engaged in this shitstorm of phony metaphysics for decades. And you know, it's such an avalanche of bad thinking and false ideas and stupidity that, you know, it's certainly in the universities, they are no longer able to sort out anything. I mean, that's exactly why you're seeing the nonsense that's going on campus now, you know, with the social justice warriors and the incredible thought policing that's going on. And, you know, which could be thought of as a kind of intellectual martial law on campus. And that has been the consequence of, you know, what's happened with postmodernism in the education system. Now, as a corollary, perhaps, you know, on the larger scale, in the bigger picture, you can see sort of the strange consequences of what's happened with our inability to think and our reality optional culture, in terms of the political disorder that we're now generating. You know, nobody expected Trump, but Trump was a direct consequence of all the reality averse politics and economics, especially, of the last 20 years. And, you know, the politics are now reaching a kind of a threshold of complete breakdown and dysfunction, at least in Washington, D.C. And, I don't think people necessarily expected it. Although I certainly wrote about it. I you know, I more or less predicted that we would see it, and I pretty much predicted that we would see the government, the federal government, would become increasingly impotent, ineffectual, and paralyzed. And also, you know, I think you can say that it's just another manifestation of the what is probably the fact that anything organized at the giant scale is now getting into trouble, whether it's a giant university or a giant corporation or a giant department store chain. You know, big institutions are now starting to fail, and you know, I think you can state categorically that these overly large, overscaled enterprises and institutions are going to systematically fail from here on. And I guess I got up kind of a rabbit hole there, so forgive me.
No, this is all fabulous. And I read somewhere, it was in one of your essays, where you were talking about the political correctness and SJWs And you said something about how, and once again, forgive me for mangling it, but you said something about how basically if you're not going to accomplish something in the real world that will resolve the class, the primary concerns of your class, you will become increasingly strident about language. But you said it much better. Does that sound familiar?
It doesn't sound all that familiar, but in fact, I wrote a blog on Monday about those issues. It was about the so-called Overton window. And a guy named Neil Devers wrote a wonderful essay on it. His essay was titled The Overton Bubble, if you want to look it up. And one of the points that he made was that as the groups became more and more insecure about their status and who they were and what they were doing and what they were accomplishing, the groupthink would become increasingly insane and make it almost impossible for the group to think. And that was the main point of his essay, the Overton Bubble. And I think it's quite correct. And I think that's exactly what you saw manifesting in the universities, where, after all, you know, the universities are supposed to be the places where good thinking is most easily available and is in regular supply. And what we're finding now, that the worst thinking in America is now coming out of the universities, and the worst behavior and the worst kind of intellectual coercion and despotism. And it's a very interesting process. But I think the key to it is what Deaver said about the insecurity of the culture. And so what we're seeing is, you know, this culture in the universities of postmodern faux pseudo metaphysical thinkers discovering that their thoughts have absolutely nothing to do with the real problems that we're facing in the real world. And so, you know, as that discovery becomes more manifest and our political predicament becomes worse, their ideas become more and more insane and strident.
Which all reminds me of, for example, the cattle killing cult in South Africa, that when your way of life is floundering, and it makes me think of Joseph Tainter too, where whatever made the culture grow in the first place, when your culture collapses, you just think if you do it more stridently and more urgently, if you're an Easter Islander and building big stone heads is what made your culture great, well, things fall apart. We just need to make more big stone heads.
Yeah, right.
And I often think of the response to global warming, for example, all the solar and wind stuff, which is actually more a response to peak oil, but leaving that aside, that for some reason, I mean, not for some reason, that in many ways feels almost like capitalism. It feels like the ghost dance of capitalism.
That's a very good way to put it.
Well, thank you.
And I can't improve on that. I think that's true. I would add one more thing that I think is very important, and it kind of comes out of Tainter, but it's an idea that is kind of a cross-platform idea from economics, and that's the diminishing returns of technology. You know, it originally maybe it comes out of Gresham's law with, you know, the diminishing returns of money. But The diminishing returns of technology are with us all the time, and they're producing more and more blowback. And Tainter's basic idea is that societies collapse when their overinvestments in increasing complexity do not produce anything of value and start producing negative value. And that's exactly what diminishing returns are. And so that's what we're seeing. You know, one of my favorite examples is the phone system. We probably spent, let's just throw this figure out here. We just probably spent $50 billion over the last 30 years computerizing the phone systems and then turning them into mobile phones and little mini computers in order to, quote, improve communication, right? And the net effect of that now is that it's impossible to get a real human being on the phone anywhere, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so how well did that work?
And
you know, how well did those massive overinvestments in complexity work? And not too well.
And go ahead.
And we're seeing it in everything. I mean, you know, that's also the same kind of thing that you're seeing in the electric driverless car. You know, this campaign to add more and more layers of complexity on a system that you know, is already excessively complex. And so, you know, the net effect of all that will be collapse of the system.
And a system that is divorced from the physical reality of the salmon who used to be in the Klamath River so thick that the entire river was black and roiling. And this year, the Klamath Indians had to cancel their salmon festival because there weren't enough salmon. I mean, so that's all divorced from the physical reality from whence we all gain our lives.
Right. You know, I do believe that this can only go on so long, and that, you know, what we're dealing with here really are systems which are subject to fragility and failure, and that they will. That's the bad news, that, you know, our techno-industrial culture and many of the activities in it are going to go away. They're going to fail. They're going to stop. You know, we're going to have to make other arrangements. The good news, if there is any good news, and if there's really much of an ecosystem for humans and other things left, is that human societies are essentially emergent, and that they will respond to the circumstances that reality presents eventually, and they will reorganize accordingly. So, you know, when this happens, and that's why I wrote those World Made by Hand novels, which was to kind of illustrate to people that, in my view, now I know that your view is a bit darker, maybe quite a bit darker, but in my view, you know, we will have this capacity to have a pretty major economic and social and political reset to a simpler way of living. Is that you or me?
That's not me. I don't think. I don't know how it would be me.
I just got a new cell phone. I had to because I'm going to France in about a week, and I need to make calls there. And I had this crappy old flip phone that I didn't want to get rid of, and Verizon told me that I couldn't get the $40 1 month overseas calling plan on that phone. So they made me get a new phone for an extra $7 a month. And I've spent about 20 hours over the last 5 days trying to figure out how to get my email running on it, and failed because it's too complex, because we've added too many layers of complex security, you know, on people's emails, so that it's now so completely incomprehensible that the people at Apple couldn't even figure out why I couldn't get the email installed on the phone.
And let's reveal a secret to the people listening to this, that as we're talking about these complexity and creating increasing problems, that this interview almost didn't take place because you and I were both getting increasingly testy because our emails were not actually arriving.
Yeah.
So this is just a great example of, we could not communicate. And thank goodness we actually had the telephone as a backup. And someday people will be saying, thank goodness we could just walk to the neighbors instead of the telephone.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have about 5 minutes left. And if somebody starts to fully internalize the fact that we are not living, that we are not currently in a reality-based system of discourse, or whatever we want to say,
mm-hmm.
What do you want individuals? What is an appropriate adult-based, reality-based, individual response to that reality? And then what would be an adult, reality-based, social response to that reality that we are not in an adult, reality-based social system? What? How do adults respond to this individually and collectively appropriately?
It is very, very difficult right now because the craziness, that the self-referential inanity of our current public discourse and our state of mind is really more like a religious hysteria. It's like national ergot poisoning. Remember ergot poisoning from the medieval period, where, you know, a medieval town would get a shipment of rye infected with a certain kind of mold that produced, this mold had psychedelic properties, so that when people ate the bread made from the ergot poisoned rye, they would have hallucinations. And that's kind of where we're at now. It's like, this is like national ergot poisoning. We're so far gone. So you have to understand the current situation as a religious frenzy. And it is very hard for people caught up in a religious frenzy to drop out of it. Because it's, you know, it is completely crazy making. And that's what you're seeing with the so-called democratic progressive wing of American politics right now. They are in a religious frenzy. And, I don't know how to tell people how to be independent of that. Most people, or many people anyway, are tied into some kind of institution, whether it's a company or a school or something, and it's very hard for them to escape the groupthink. I mean, I'd hate to imagine what it's like to work on a college faculty right now and have an independent point of view. You know, you'd be crushed. You'd be persecuted.
Well, last week I interviewed Brett Weinstein, who the campus police, he teaches at Evergreen, and the campus police told him, "We cannot protect you because there were roving gangs of students with baseball bats looking for him."
Well, they were told by the college president not to protect him.
Yes, I know. I'm validating your point of what happens to somebody who does not go along with the groupthink.
It's a religious frenzy, and you kind of have to really just do what you can, lay low, contribute what you can as a public thinker or intellectual or participant. You know, try to be a little brave about it. Try to stand up to the forces of religious persecution. I think what might mitigate it is, you know, in my view, there's no question that we're heading into some kind of a crisis pretty soon. And I do maintain that it's going to be a financial and economic crisis. Although right now the political crisis has really gained a lot of it's really gained a lot of ground in the last 6 months, and it's starting to race neck and neck with the financial and economic crisis. It's beginning to look like both of these things are going to kind of burst at the same time, you know, maybe the end of the summer, the fall sometime. And when we do have a major economic crisis, if it's an enormous drop in the financial markets, or a currency crisis, or the freezing up of bank accounts, the attempt to force people into a cashless society, as Jim Rickards has been warning people about. You know, if we have a government, you know, a crisis of government in which, President Trump is forced out for one reason or another. And of course, I'm not a Trump fan, but I wasn't a Hillary fan either. I think those things are going to combine to act sort of like a whack in the head with a 2x4 to the American public, and especially to American elites and the thinking classes. And I think what you'll see is, as soon as that happens, they're going to instantly drop their preoccupations with transsexuals and start paying attention to things that are important.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And I guess I'm going to ask one more thing, well, very briefly, or just make a statement that I love the line by Milan Kundera that the struggle against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And it seems to apply too, that the struggle against a non-reality-based consensus is to hold tight to reality and to broadcast reality as much as you can.
There you go. Now, I'd also like to add my very brief new theory of history so people can understand, you know, what's going on.
Please.
My new theory of history is that things happen because they seem like a good idea at the time.
Oh, I want that's great. And I want to add one more thing, or ask one more thing, which is the line you said before we started the recorder about sleeping.
Oh,
I love that sleeping. Line. Let's just end with that. It's beautiful.
I don't remember what I said about sleeping.
It was nuisance. People make a lot of mischief.
Oh, yeah. It's my alternate theory of human relations.
And we're going to end on this.
People make an endless amount of mischief when they're awake.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been James Howard Kunstler. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.